Media Focus with Paul Blanchard.
This week, bias in sports reporting. Can news channels be trusted to report the stories fairly, even if they sponsor many of the top teams? Making money from music. The UK music industry made more money last year from vinyl than they did from YouTube. How can the industry turn a sustainable profit? And what's next for journalism training? With news agencies turning to automated news robots to write website copy, what skills do the next generation of reporters need to compete? And joining us as usual are two of the media's best and brightest. James Porter is head of UK journalism training for the BBC. And Rob Lewis is CEO and founder of Electric Jukebox.
Media Focus.
So first up, the sports world has been shaken by a series of scandals in football, cycling and now athletics. A few have suggested that the UK's top news stations can't report on these stories fairly because broadcasters, including Sky and the BBC, not only own the rights to these sports but also have sponsorship deals with some of the top teams and leagues and thus have a vested interest in keeping their public images clean. James, do you think this is a conflict of interest?
I certainly hope not. As someone who spent a large part of my career working in sports news, at one stage leading the department for the BBC, I would be horrified if there was a conflict of interest there. I can see the potential for it, but I don't think it's necessarily any stronger in sports journalism than any other field of journalism, you know, in music journalism or in travel journalism or business journalism. There's relationships with companies or sponsors or record labels that if somebody in the magazine or whatever might be critical of them, then that could be seen as a conflict of interest. But I think that the journalistic instincts of the journalists are such that they hopefully overcome that. I was listening to your recent interview with Richard Conway, and anybody that heard that, I'd like to see them try and tell him not to run a story because it wasn't in the best interest of the company he was working for. I think you'd see them being torn limb for limb as he was pursuing that story. So, no, I don't think there is a conflict of interest, but I can see why people might be concerned about that. But I think also if the broadcasters were never pursuing these stories, then, you know, you might be able to look at it and say if the stories were only coming out in the printed media, oh, well, the broadcasters are holding off. But, you know, if you look at FIFA, for example, and some of the stuff that Andrew Jennings did for Panorama, going back, I remember on the couple of days before the announcement of the World Cup, when England bid for the World Cup and the ones that went to Russia and Qatar, a few days before that deadline, the BBC running a panorama that Andrew Jennings did about FIFA, and there was uproar. And if you remember, the BBC were kind of portrayed as being against the country's best interests and trying to undermine the process. And Andrew Jennings has done a tremendous amount of work on FIFA. Richard has picked up some of that. He's carrying that on. So I think there's plenty of evidence where the broadcasters are trying to track these stories down. But they're not easy to get to because it's taken a long time for FIFA to be found out. It's taken a long time for the full extent of what was going on in Russian athletics to be unearthed. People had their suspicions, and lots of journalists were looking for that story. But it's only now that once the first sort of, if you like, the lid was lifted on it, and suddenly everyone's noticing quite how rotten everything is within. But these stories are not easy to unearth.
Do you think, though, if you were a BBC executive, if you've got one of your, on the one hand, one of your journalists uncovering some, shall we say, unethical practices in sports rights and so on, and yet on the other hand, you've got your executives bidding, you know, for cricket or football or whatever it's going to be, the broadcast rights, do you ever think that they wish that their journalists wouldn't be as vociferous so that they could probably get a better deal?
I think there might be times where they might think it could make life a little easier.
Unhelpful.
But at the same time, when I was running the sports news area, my boss running sport was pushing me and my team to break sports news stories. So he was very fond of saying, you know, that there must be very clear Chinese walls in place. So the rights negotiations go on. But meanwhile, BBC journalism, because it is absolutely at the heart of what the BBC does. And I know colleagues who work at Sky News as well. And if you told them, if there was a cycling drug story and you told them to go easy on it because Sky sponsor a cycling team, that there's absolutely no way they'd accept that. So I think possibly there's a little bit of bosses that might think, oh, this would make my life a bit easier, but actually they wouldn't have it any other way. And I think they would say to the rights holders, look, you know, that's what the BBC bring to this. We deal with everything impartially. We're not going to cozy up to you and turn a blind eye if we think that. But I think actually the rights holders kind of respect that. And that most importantly, I think the audiences know that now. So gone are the days where the audiences will just accept, you know, no attempt to unearth these stories. And I think it's not just the sort of news story angle. In the sports coverage itself, increasingly now, right across the piece, you hear, I think there's a sort of expectation that pundits will speak their mind, you know, and actually they get criticised for not doing so, don't they? And we see it in all the press. So I think... you know, there was a great story about an American journalist years ago who was working for CBS who criticised the state of the greens at Augusta for the Masters one year because he thought they were so fast they were ruining the tournament, and he said it looked like they'd been bikini waxed. And next thing you know, his accreditation was withdrawn, and I don't think he's got it back 20 years on.
Wow.
So there have been examples where it hasn't been in people's best interest, but I think nowadays we, the viewers or the listeners, expect our pundits to be pretty critical if they think something's wrong, and I think it would stand out like a sore thumb if we weren't doing it now.
Rob, do you think that executives in kind of rights management will get used to the duality of this? That in one way, on one hand, you're dealing with the BBC in terms of doing a business deal. It would happen in music as well. If you're going to make deals for, you know, putting your artists on the various platforms. But on the other hand, they might also attack you if they feel that you're not doing a good job, as it were. And maybe you've just got to get used to both sides of the relationship.
Well, if you're running a music service these days, curation is very important because actually a lot of consumers, if they've got access to 30 million tracks, they don't know what they want to listen to. So curation is key. And actually, we do see in the music arena, and every single music service, be it Spotify or Electric Jukebox or Napster or Apple Music, has the same fundamental issue, which is you've got freedom of expression in terms of you can create any playlist, but you do need to make sure across all the record labels that you have a fair proportion of their content on average based on their market share. So There is an element of the commerce moving into the editorial side of the business, but it's only in terms of fairness across the board, in terms of representing market share, rather than actually us being forced to actually publish individual playlists.
So, for example, Spotify has a six music playlist, so yeah. I could listen to that, but I could also listen to the actual six music as well on BBC. So how does that work in terms of you're almost competing against yourself?
Yeah, so what you see is for any individual music service, the rights owners will be actually monitoring the proportion of their tracks as opposed to all of the tracks that are actually being published on the service across all of the different playlists that exist. Not an individual playlist, but across all of them. And essentially making sure that Universal or the Independents or Warner or Sony Music, no one's getting special treatment. So it's not so much a case of individual music services doing what they're told to do by you must publish this artist, you must put this single at the top of this playlist. It's more the commercial side of the business is paranoid that perhaps there is one label over another that has preferential treatment.
I mean, James, that's an interesting point that Rob makes, that as you've just alluded to, there's very strong Chinese walls between editorial and the kind of deal-making. If you look at the BBC, you've got robust journalists that wouldn't dream of, you know, pulling any punches because of the BBC, on another hand, might be doing a deal with them. And then, as you've just said, you've got these executives that also would expect to be, you know, welcomed by one side of the BBC commercially and punched in the face repeatedly by the editorial. I'm exaggerating here. Rob was saying something very interesting there, that in a sense, isn't that a dying breed, that kind of where the two camps are very separate, and that actually there's this blurring between editorial and commerciality?
Yeah, I see what you mean in terms of kind of structurally, perhaps, but I think, and I hope this isn't just naivety on my part, but I think you need to think about what motivates people to become sports journalists in the first place, in this instance. And if you are given a job, if you want to get a job at the BBC, you know, you build up a portfolio of breaking stories, and then you're employed at the BBC or at Sky or wherever that might be, and suddenly you don't break any stories at all because you're kowtowing to whichever rights organisation it might be because you don't want to upset them, you're not going to stay in a job for very long, or your profile is going to drop right down. And, you know, I think journalists, all journalists have that little bit of ego in them that likes to be, you're the guy that broke that story, you're the woman that broke that story, fantastic. And so I think I hope that will out. And I know that might sound kind of a bit idealistic and a bit naive, but I think you only have to look at the, you know, what happened at the Daily Telegraph with HSBC. And I think, you know, the concerns when the FT was sold, journalists, it really matters to them that they do have that editorial independence. And, you know, I think the minute people do start to take that away and say, no, you can't run that story, I think that's very different to we expect you to take a particular slant on a story. We all know which papers are going to give us a slightly right-wing slant, which are going to give us a more left-wing slant. So I think journalists accept that, and that's one of the appeals for going to a particular newspaper. But I think it's very different to being told, no, you can't run that story.
But do we think also in, as we have more and more new media, which is they're run by very small organisations where perhaps actually, you know, they're not the brand of the BBC or Sky News or a national newspaper, but they may have millions or tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of followers.
YouTube people,
exactly.
Podcasters like us, citizen journalists, I mean, bloggers.
As we've seen with a lot of YouTube, there was that on YouTube very recently, we've seen this, but we know that there's a blurring of the lines on some of these YouTube channel owners where there are tens or even hundreds of millions of viewers. Because you haven't got the safeguard, actually, it's all about traffic, traffic, traffic.
Yeah, and with the sort of native advertising and that's right, it was the videos, wasn't it, the video advertising. But then there was, there's a reaction to that, isn't there? And I suppose, I think for the larger brands, the danger of a backlash like that, I guess, if you're looking for a negative reason for it not to happen, the backlash and the damage that something like that would do to you, I think that probably helps keep you honest. But, the journalists I've been lucky enough to work with, they would, if anything, I think it would make them more determined to try and break a story if they were warned off by their own side, as it were. I think that would almost make them more determined to break the story rather than, you know, they'd be more likely to just go, oh, okay, fine, yeah, I'll look somewhere else for a story then.
I mean, Rob, that's an interesting point there. Where do you think the pressure comes on people that aren't as institutional as, say, the BBC? Like you said, your bloggers and so on. I mean, the Advertising Standards Authority have weighed in. In fact, we had the CEO in here a while ago. He's starting to get involved in liaising with people with, you know, many, many millions of YouTube followers because they are doing editorial YouTube videos that say, look at how great this product is, and they're not declaring the fact that they have a financial relationship. And one of the things that struck me about that is in many ways, the younger audience don't seem to care.
I think there's also the issue that even if they do acknowledge the fact that there is a commercial interest, that perhaps a lot of consumers don't necessarily understand what that really means. If you, even on the Daily Mail's online presence, which is one of the biggest online presences in the whole world, if you look down the right-hand column,
the so-called sidebar
stories, there are quite a lot of stories that say advertising related. I can't remember exactly what the phrase is, but they're signposted as being advertorial.
Sponsored, I think,
but
is the word
they use. They look almost identical to a news story, and I'd say 9 out of 10 of the consumers are not going to know the difference. And that blurring of the lines, I think it's mainly happening online. I'd be horrified if at the BBC, if the actual sports news was being in some way affected commercially. And I hope and suspect that that's not the case. But I do think when we're moving into the world of online, and particularly small online properties, the temptation to do it is huge.
You're absolutely right that a large number of the viewers or consumers, however they might choose to consume, are either not aware or are not bothered. If it's the second, I think that's okay. If it's the former and they're not aware, then I think for all of us that's a real concern because I think that's a dangerous precedent for those of us who believe in the kind of the world of journalism and the role of journalists in telling the truth and in unearthing, holding people to account. If content that isn't independent is being rolled out and nobody really knows whether it is or isn't, then, but you know, you lose that trust, which is absolutely at the cornerstone. So I think it's a big challenge for all of us. I think you're right that the bigger the institution, almost the not the less likely it is, because that's a bit, you know, they were saying that in the bankers crisis, weren't they? But you know, I think it's more noticeable and easier to hold someone to account and say, hang on, why have you done that, or that is sponsored content. But, yeah, I mean, I know, you know, my kids consume a load of stuff that they just look at. And if I said to them, do you know whether that's true or not? They'd be like, well, it's true because it's there. And I think that could be a worry for us all.
Yeah, I mean, at the BBC, you have long-term established principles over many, many decades as to the difference between editorial and the commercial side of the business. And I'm sure there is a little bit of blurring lines from time to time. But in a new business or something that's been going for 5 or 10 years with a relatively small team, which is at the mercy of who can get the online advertising this month in order to survive, I don't think those rules are set down in stone. I think they're set down in pencil.
Yeah. You know, if we're all you call us back in 10 years' time for another chat,
yeah,
it will be really interesting to see how that has developed, because I think that is the pace of it is going to only accelerate as the size you need to be to publish decreases. Then the chances of that happening, and as you say, the pressure to get the finance in to enable you to do what you want to do creatively, means that you may well blur those lines.
And there are a number of factors quite interesting online. So Google, when they're reviewing news feeds for Google News, take into account the robot's ability to identify whether it's advertorial or real editorial, and their perception of whether how it's been linked to, and therefore how likely it is to be real content. So Google itself is actually playing a part in actually promoting the real editorial, notwithstanding the fact that that's being done by a robot rather than a human being, so I'm sure it's not perfect.
But isn't this just the if you like, the modern day or the development in PR, where PR has, you know, part of PR has been about trying to get a message put out there. I don't know, look at someone like travel PR or consumer PR, and, you know, there are good exponents of travel journalism who will write what they want to about a holiday per se, even if they've been on the fam trip. But there are others, perhaps slightly less scrupulous, and always have been, who will kind of write what the PR wants them to write. And it's only, I think it's kind of the digital equivalent of that, effectively. You know, I think the challenge is that we try and find ways of noting if it matters to us. For some of us, it will matter. Others may not be bothered by it.
So next up, challenging times for the British music industry. In spite of clocking up more than 14 billion views on YouTube last year, the industry actually made more money from selling vinyl than it did online. With the launch of Apple Music and YouTube's new streaming service, which both have premium features, the industry is seeking to innovate to generate revenue. Rob, will these developments change the way people feel about paying for music online?
It's interesting you bring up the statistic with YouTube versus vinyl, because both are actually very small in terms of revenue for both the British industry and the music industry worldwide. The only thing that's actually significant and growing is paid-for streaming, as in ad-free streaming. But unfortunately, there's only 40 million people on the whole of planet Earth who are doing that today, and that's even after Apple Music's launch. And actually, we've done a lot of research in the Electric... We got YouGov to do the research for the Electric Jukebox Company, where we asked consumers, why haven't they adopted this stuff? Because it seems to me that having access to all the music in the world is so much better than buying it album by album or track by track.
I declare an interest. I'm a Spotify subscriber. Okay. And very happy at that.
So you're one of the 40 million.
I am indeed.
And you're very happy, and you'd probably never think of ever desubscribing, because it would be a horror to go back to the world of track by track.
Well, I'd lose all my playlists as well, so that would be the end of my entire life.
So you're one of those 40 million, but there used to be 200 million people in the world buying a CD every single month, and about another 500 million buying a CD, say, 5 or 6 times a year.
Incredible. Catching the bus to Woolworths of a Saturday morning to buy a CD.
I remember it very well.
As do I.
and then it was Our Price and
it was,
HMV.
Yeah.
And there's still some HMVs around. And actually, they're selling a lot of vinyl now. But the future is clearly streaming. And the question is, how do we get from an audience of tech-savvy, happy with monthly recurring subscriptions, downloading apps, want to listen on their mobile phone to music when they go jogging in the morning, to the kind of mainstream market who used to buy CDs? And that's the big challenge that the industry has to focus on, is taking it from 40 million back to 200 million. And it's a big challenge, because streaming's been aggressively sold by many means to the consumer base for over 10 years now. So it's quite surprising that it's such a small proportion of consumers who are doing it today.
And of these 200 million that were buying CDs, clearly that doesn't translate to the 40 million. What have the 160 million people started to do? Are they just not buying CDs anymore? Are they not purchasing music physically? Or are they listening to the radio? Where's it gone?
Well, so the YouGov research suggested that if you look at an average UK household and you say, is music at home important to you? Unsurprisingly, 90% of people will go, yes, it's really key. So how are they listening to music? And we in London, sitting in a broadcasting or recording a studio with, I mean, I'm sure we're all relatively tech savvy, we might be surprised by this, but the number one way they listen to music is radio, 52%. And then it's a CD or hi-fi, 42%. And some form of streaming solution is only 8%.
Incredible.
So it hasn't swept the world, the streaming solution, in the same way the web's swept through media. And we went on to ask consumers, so why haven't you done this? And this is the interesting bit. The top four reasons why they haven't adopted streaming are: it's too complicated to set up, it's too complicated to do, it's too expensive, and the number one of all, I hate monthly recurring subscriptions and I'll never do that. So the challenge we've been trying to address at the Electric Jukebox is to come up with a solution for everyone else, not to compete with Spotify, to create a solution which comes in a box, you plug it in, 2 minutes later you've got all the music in the world at home, rather than buy a Sonos box here, buy a controller like an Android tablet
and fill in your direct debit details here,
and then create a sort of Spotify subscription, then like 2 hours later you've got something that works. Try and create something that just comes in a box and it just works, and the subscription is included in the cost of the device. And I think we hope that by doing that we can start bringing this wonderful streaming experience to a much wider audience, because it needs to, or the music industry is going to have really serious problems over the next 5 to 10 years.
And how do you think it will work in terms of your competitors, as it were? I mean, because there's only a finite number of deals that the music industry can do with competing libraries, as it were. So is there always going to be Taylor Swift solely on Apple but not on Spotify, and, you know, the Hollies on yours and not on, say, Spotify, etc.?
Well, clearly the whole idea of music not being on everything is contrary to the whole idea of having access to everything. The actual reality is the way that the market's changing, and I don't think many people are aware of this, is that the music industry is moving strongly against the idea of free streaming services and heavily towards paid for, or if you like, ad-free services. So the reason why Taylor Swift is not on Spotify is not because she's on Apple Music. She's actually on lots of streaming services. It's because Spotify have a free service. In addition to that, there are a whole bunch of artists, and in fact, the record labels themselves, who are increasingly restricting the catalogue that's available on free service.
So forgive me, I've never actually had the free version. I always just thought it was £10 a month, I'll start straight away. But if you go for the ad-supported version, how does that actually work?
So you sit on your laptop, you have a lesser catalogue, and you receive audiovisual ads a little bit like the radio, but it's fully on demand. But that fully on demand service is only available on a streaming basis. The reality is that the amount of money that the labels and indeed the artists get from a stream on a free service is minuscule. I mean, on YouTube, there's not even a minimum amount per play that's played, which is why the number of plays is horrifically large and the amount of revenue is so small.
Mm.
And it's clear, whilst these free services are very good for breaking a new artist or a new album, the same way that radio play has been historically, that they're almost too good for the consumer. They're certainly too good to encourage them to take up a premium service. So what's happening at the end of this year and towards the middle of next year is that as the rights come up for renewal, is we're seeing a larger and larger proportion of the catalogue being removed from YouTube and removed from Spotify Free, etc., as the industry trying to grows up to try and say, if you want everything, we are going to ask you to pay at least something.
I was at a friend's house the other day and he likes a bit of Queen from time to time, and his telly was on and he called up the YouTube app on his HDTV, typed in Queen, and there was a playlist with almost all of the videos that they had, and he just set it going and left it in the background. And I think there were a few visual adverts over the songs, and there was every three or four songs there was an advert, but other than that, it just kind of worked.
Yeah, no, so this is the very issue we're talking about. The trend is going to be over the next 6 to 12 months, that as a result of changes in rights, that you essentially have two different types of proposition. The £10 or $10 or €10 a month unlimited access on all your devices, which is a kind of one individual consumer having the rights to everything. That will have full catalogue. And then you'll have products like ours, the Electric Jukebox, which are kind of a bit of hardware. You open the box, you plug it in, and the whole family have all the music in the world at home, but without a subscription. And then you'll have truly free web services like YouTube or Spotify Free, which I think people will start to find increasingly don't have that breadth of catalogue because the catalogue's being withdrawn. And I think that's a good thing for the music industry, because ultimately, as you say, if 12 billion views result in less revenue than vinyl, then there's something seriously wrong going on. And what's going on wrong is that the free streams are degrading the consumer proposition for premium services that ad free, and also preventing the industry grow as quickly as it really should. Because ultimately, the idea of having all the music in the world at home is such a beautiful experience. It's so much of a better format change than cassette to CD. And it should really be something that hundreds of millions of people are using today, not 40 million.
It strikes me that, that's the key, is that stage when what you can get for free is sufficiently lower standard than what you have to pay for. Because then you think...
Then
there's a reason to upgrade. So if I'm thinking, I don't know, of a parallel with... if you think about the way you might watch films on your TV... So there was a time when Sky Movies, you know, you paid your subscription to that because, you know, that was the only way you got anything that wasn't on the BBC or ITV or Channel 4.
Then, or you bought a DVD.
You know, yeah. And now there's Netflix and there's Amazon Prime and people are developing these services and they're acquiring the content. And we're all aware of the fact that they've got it. So if we want that, we have to find. So it strikes me... not as a great music consumer, but that the parallels are there with other forms of entertainment.
Yep.
That at the moment, I'm interested what you say about the rights coming up and what you can get on YouTube and free Spotify diminishes as a product, then you can see perhaps more of a shift coming. But there's also that resourcefulness amongst consumers, isn't there, that... You see, which is, if there is a way around it, and if there is a way to access this, or one person pays for it and shares it with all their friends, you know, that there is that challenge that the more technically aware, who perhaps might be the audience who would be your early adopters, are also finding ways to mitigate against that cost by sharing the content with other people, you know, frankly, illegally, I guess, if that's not too strong a word, but certainly without paying subscriptions for it.
I mean, I think you're also right about the parallels with other types of media as well, because the other key thing, which I think is very important with music services, is the curation, because it's not about just having access to 30 million tracks. It's also about having really high quality curation for... I want a party, or I want to chill out, or it's a barbecue, or Sunday afternoon, and putting real personalities behind that. So, for example, we've just signed up people like Stephen Fry and Robbie Williams to give us all their personal playlists. Now, that the individual tracks that are composed in that, some of those will be on YouTube. But actually, the fact that the consumer has the convenience of immediately being able to go in and see all of Robbie or Stephen Fry's personal playlists, click on them and immediately play them, that actually has as much value to the consumer having access to the playlist itself as the actual track itself.
These guys are running out of things to have privately, aren't they?
Yeah.
Pretty much everything they own.
Do you think, Rob, that the in a sense, the film industry has got one over on you so far? Have they kind of just got to market a bit quicker? Because, you know, gone are the days when you would go into someone's house and see a whole wall of DVDs on the shelves. I mean, most people nowadays, certainly amongst my friends, you know, are quite discerning streaming customers. They have Sky, they have Netflix, and they have Amazon. They have all three. So, I mean, we have some DVDs and Blu-rays at home, but like 20. The rest of it, we know we can just get online.
Yes, I think the music industry suffered from the fact that when all this digital stuff happened, they were much more subject to piracy as an early stage. Mm. And that was essentially because of the fact the file sizes for music are very small compared with video. And also it was, to be frank, because the music industry made a huge strategic error when Steve Jobs turned up with iTunes to go essentially instantaneously from the idea of selling albums to entirely singles, which was a shocking error when you consider the level of revenue reduction per transaction and the fact that many people were buying an album for only one or two of the tracks on the album. And secondly, to allow them carte blanche when it was a grey area in law to do sideloading, to put your CDs in and upload the thing and immediately create this digital arena without any form of DRM on the sideloaded tracks. Whereas in the film industry, the digitalization of a Blu-ray disc is much more difficult, and it's an enormous file, and it's not something that can be easily shared, and you certainly can't put a Blu-ray disc into iTunes and then end up with a DRM-free version of it. So the music industry, unfortunately, historically, have allowed themselves to go down a certain path, often when it's been Apple executives inviting them in to see the next exciting new gizmo.
And do you think curation is a way for the industry to kind of play catch-up here? Because, for example, it doesn't port well to films in the same way that music does. I mean, I might listen to Stephen Fry's 30 favourite tracks and that might while away a Sunday afternoon. But if Mark Kermode gives me his 10 favourite films, I'd probably read that and be interested in it. But I wouldn't want to watch all 10 films there and then, because that would take me the best part of 2 days.
No, absolutely. That would be a very long weekend. It would be. Not much sleep at all. I definitely think curation is a really critical component here. There's no question that when you're looking at a 20 or 30 track playlist, if you are creating a party or a Sunday afternoon barbecue, you want a very seamless transition from the first track to the last. You want some tracks that are tracks that you know very well. You want to discover some new tracks, and you don't want any jarring between tracks. And really, really good curation from excellent curators enables you to create a product in its own right that through the curation is better than the sum of the parts. I mean, in fact, if you think of Ministry of Sound, they were essentially curators. The vast majority of their content was not ever created. They just created a CD from content, and that's what the customers were paying for. That's often what people pay for with an excellent DJ. And so I think as well as bringing streaming music services into the home and making them easy by not requiring app downloads or $10 a month subscriptions and so on, the other really big thing the music industry has to do is to focus on fabulous curation. The day that you get home and you're sitting there at a dinner party and you absolutely trust a service to put the music on for the whole of your dinner party rather than think about creating a playlist yourself is the day those services become an integral part of our lives. Okay, you might want to suddenly decide to play that 80s track that you haven't played for 20 years, but it's actually the freedom to play anything you want, but the ability to play things based on mood, genre, era, or how you're feeling or what you're doing, and making sure those playlists are of exceptional quality that really sings.
And James, do you think that is a way that the music industry can you know, steal a march then, as it were, that, you know, if you're putting a dinner party on to impress the mother-in-law, for example, you could just put Radio 2 on or something like that, but you know quite, you know, not much of a guarantee as to what will be played. But if, for example, if you go on Spotify now, on a Sunday morning, I can click Sunday morning playlist, and there isn't just one, there's 80 different kinds of Sunday morning playlists, inspirational, chill out, Sunday morning coffee, all of these kind of things. Do you think that kind of incredibly precise playlist curation is actually the future?
I think it's could be the future, and I think there are plenty of times when one would want to have that degree of choice and knowledge of what is coming. I think personally, I still like occasionally to hear something that I wasn't expecting. It's a bit like the argument about whether you have a TV channel or whether we go to watching everything on demand.
Endless box sets.
Yeah, or you know, everything is time shifted. And effectively, you are then curating your own television playlist, aren't you? And I'm sure you remember five years ago, people saying TV channels are dead, and yet they're not. At the moment, they're still, you know, relatively alive and kicking, most of them. So I think there's possibly something in all of us that every now and then just likes to hear something or watch something that we weren't expecting. And we think, oh, that's fantastic, or that's rubbish, or whatever, but it's just nice to hear it. But I think for great swathes of the time, yeah, certainly, the more, if you like, the more precise you can be in your definition and in ensuring that everything on your Sunday morning mellow playlist is indeed a Sunday morning, and, you know, your barbecue music hits the right mood for. I'm trying to think what the barbecue music would sound like, but you know, I think, yeah.
80s rock.
80s rock. Broadly speaking.
Or some death metal, I don't know.
That's your barbecue.
Well, I think that's an interesting, actually. When you say, Rob, that's your barbecue, I suppose that's the challenge as well, though, is my barbecue and your barbecue could be very different. So how sophisticated the curation has to be to allow. So I guess perhaps in the future there'll be a thing where you kind of outline broadly what your taste is.
It will learn from my behaviour what kind of barbecue I want.
Well,
I mean,
the other really significant thing is that music's gone from being something that we kind of share together properly to something that's quite, and this is one of the things that we're trying to resolve, that's very personal. So in the old days, I used to sit there with cassettes or vinyl and we'd around the living room table. I'd pass it around and we'd discuss what we were going to play and we'd know what we were playing. Increasingly today, somebody gets sent into the corner with an iPod, puts it into a docking station and they put on and we've got no idea what's being played. And in fact, if I try and grab it from him in order to put some music on, they'll probably get upset because who knows what else is on his phone. And we need to move back into that world where in the living room we're deciding what to play together, which is kind of what we're partly trying to do, a shared appliance for the whole family with voice control where on the screen you can see what's playing, you can choose together. Because we only learn about music if we know what we're listening to. And when everyone's having their own isolated experience on a mobile phone, we've got no idea what's being played. We just know who's been told to go and, inverted commas, do the music.
What's the power of celebrity-curated playlists over, say, someone else? So, for example, you know, you mentioned about Stephen Fry. I like Stephen Fry. Yeah. If he gave me a list of books to read, I'd probably be interested in that. But actually, am I interested in his taste in music? The answer is I don't know. I'd have to see. But if you gave me someone like Michael Bublé, if you said if he curated a list, I think, well, what are his influences? I wonder whether you could shed a bit of light on that.
Well, when we saw Stephen Fry to discuss this, he said, you do know I have the best taste in music in the world.
Oh, he hasn't looked at my playlist, unfortunately, so he'd quickly retreat from that.
He does actually have really quite exceptionally interesting taste in music, and that's also possibly because he's probably the cleverest person I've ever met.
He's a true Renaissance man,
yes.
And we're all a huge fan.
And when the ideal thing is a new product like the Electric Jukebox, obviously, is to not only have celebrities who can make a lot of noise, but also who actually are very good curators. And those are the ones we've got, like Sheryl Crow and Robbie Williams and so on. But we've also got people like Rob Dickens. So most people don't know who Rob Dickens is, but he's on the same list. He was the man who essentially invented the Brits, invented Enya, took Madonna from an unknown artist to someone who was a superstar, curated all her albums. So it's really critical to have proper tastemakers as well as actually celebrities who are tastemakers, because ultimately, when you're saying to somebody, I'm going to give you fantastic curation, the personalities are key, but ultimately the playlists are going to be very good too.
And finally, if you read the news regularly, you've probably read an article written by a robot, even if you didn't realise it at the time. That's because more news agencies are choosing to replace human reporters with automated news writing algorithms, which sounds dreadful. In reaction, journalism tutors are saying their courses should focus on teaching students things that robots can't learn, the so-called soft skills like how to hunt down stories, ethics, and securing that elusive exclusive. James, should we leave the writing to the computers while us humans focus on the softer side?
There's a thought. I do think that there is definitely room for both. So I think it's very interesting at the moment. I think there is some of the, you know, the two sort of big areas, as I understand it, at the moment around robot journalism are in some sports reporting and in some financial reporting.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of me thinks it's quite liberating for journalists that if the quarterly...
Liberated from the tedium of having to actually report the scores and they can...
Yeah, well, if the quarterly earnings of, you know, I think Associated Press have done quite a lot of this, haven't they? And I was reading that, you know, they used to publish 300 quarterly earnings reports and now it's 3,000 because they've got algorithms doing it. And I think if that frees the journalist up to pursue slightly more in-depth stories that require, you know, a bit more work and give him or her the chance to ferret around a bit and find, you know, what we would call good stories, rather than just processing mundane information. I think that's a good thing and to be encouraged. And yes, I think the key for the tutors is how can we enable and what skills can we give our want-to-be journalists that enable them to add value to a story? You know, I think... if we just produce a load of journalists who churn out fairly formulaic reports that can be easily mimicked by a machine, then we're doing something wrong, I think, as trainers. If we're producing journalists that just reach for the cliches and say the same thing week after week, which enables an algorithm to mimic it, then maybe that, you know, that journalism isn't very good and needs to be improved. But
so
I think,
a journalism equivalent of the Turing test, then? Can you actually tell whether a real journalist has written it?
Yeah. Well, I think so, yeah. And I think you're absolutely right when you say, you know, we need to be looking at context to stories. We need to be looking at taking it to that next layer that gets beyond just the simple statement of fact that, you know, this football match finished 3-2. The goals were scored by A, B and C in the 12th minute, the 14th minute and the 18th minute. But that doesn't necessarily tell you anything about it, or it doesn't tell you that the person that scored the goal had only come on as a substitute 1 minute earlier, or the person that scored the goal this week was a doubt whether they were going to play. And so even with those fairly mundane reports, I think there's still the scope for journalists to complement or to add to what the robots are providing. But I do think that there is an audience need for that kind of very quick, quite low level of information that we consume online, or, you know, via our phones or however that might be, kind of instantly, that probably actually there is an area, there is an opportunity for this sort of robot journalism, and it serves it really well.
But do you think the opportunity for robot journalists is inherently limited to certain sectors? I mean, sports and financials are quite fact-based, you know, and all you really want to know ultimately is who won the football match, and a robot can tell you that. Of course, a human can go into more detail, but I'm struggling to think of other areas that a robot could actually even make a stab at.
It sort of ties into the last topic we were discussing, in that, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, the thought of having curated lists of, yeah, of music provided for you, people would go, well, you're mad, you know. But now you're looking at the next step beyond that, let alone the actual curation itself. So I think at the moment, although it was interesting, there was a story in the States, wasn't there, where first report of an earthquake was provided by a robot, because it was, again, an algorithm that was there, and all it needed to know was, where's the centre, what's the reading on the Richter scale, bang, there's your snap that goes out saying, earthquake measuring this, you know, centre that. And so I think there are those quite factual areas. I'm sure, you know, that look how Facebook algorithms have developed over the last 5 years. Who's to say, you know, what journalism algorithms, if there is such a phrase, will exist in 5 years' time? So I'm not saying I think that, you know, we're all under threat and journalism will cease to exist or anything. But I do think that for journalism tutors, to answer your actual question, we do need to be thinking about, yeah, those skills that enable you to add value to what can just be generated just by simply churning out statistics.
I mean, there's definitely an analogy with music. Because we have all kinds of wonderful automatic playlisting tools done by robots. I can get a robot to create me 15,000 different playlists based on different genres, mood, speed, type of music, period of recording, etc. But I'm always going to get something that is nowhere near as personality-led as something that's hand-curated, where somebody's spent a huge amount of time slowly building a playlist that doesn't jar. If it's done by a robot, it will jar occasionally between tracks. There will be some errors, because however much metadata a robot has on 30 million tracks, it's not actually a human being. It can't actually listen to the music, really. And the same is true of journalism. There's a vast amount of journalism that one reads that ultimately is just pure factual. And if we can spend more time within a newsroom, actually people putting real personality and investigative reporting behind the stuff that the humans are doing, it can only be a good thing, when there's clearly not infinite editorial budgets everywhere.
Yeah, because I do think that as we as a society accumulate more and more data about individual preferences and the way that individuals lead their life, that can, and I'm not a sort of, you know, H.G. Wells of the 21st century, but that clearly enables potentially robots to process more of that data. But I do think that there's always going to be a place as well for the, you know, for the person who's looking at someone as they're speaking, thinking, you're not telling me the truth here. And the person who can link a comment that's said over on this side about a particular topic, and then suddenly thinks, hang on, that, you know, I read something about that the other day, or that doesn't feel right to me, and then pursues a story that way.
But do you think this is a way for journalists to become more efficient, for them to focus on this area of the job? Or do you think ultimately it's going to add to the pressure for journalism cuts, that there'll be fewer journalists in the newsroom? Rather than freeing them up to do more, cash-strapped newspaper owners will say, well, actually, we had 8 journalists, let's just get 6 in. And then 2 journalists have lost their jobs.
That's a very good question. And I think instinctively, I would imagine that we'll end up with your 2 journalists lose their job scenario. I think there might be a period beforehand where, again, I think if you ask the Associated Press, they'll say that all these extra stories they're doing, they haven't shed a journalist job yet. But again, if we when we come back for our reunion show in 10 years' time...
If we're still alive,
we will see evidence where some newsrooms have replaced journalism roles. But I also do genuinely believe there will still be plenty of newsrooms where there are journalists who are working, if you like, if there is such a thing, working alongside an algorithm, and the product will include material that's generated by humans as well as by machines.
Of course, there's one other element that we're missing here, which is, as well as actually writing stories, there is a journalist's job of actually the news editor role of which stories are the top stories. And the number one news site in the world, which is Google News, there isn't anyone in the newsroom. It's all robots. The number one news resource on planet Earth has not a single journalist in it.
Well, gentlemen, I think that's a good point to end on because we're running out of metaphorical tape. It's just time enough now for us to mention how people can follow your work and you on Twitter, etc. James, should we start with yourself? Are you on Twitter? How do people follow what you're up to?
I am on Twitter and I'm at Porter_James.
And tell us, what do you do for the BBC in terms of journalism training?
I think it's really just trying to make sure that the skills that BBC journalists need to hopefully continue to be right on the top of their game and providing content that our audiences want on platforms that they want it on. So making sure that they're equipped with those skills because, you know, as we've been discussing, it's changing very fast. So we need to make sure that they can do what they want to.
Rob, tell us about Electric Jukebox. How do we buy one and how do we check out what you're doing online?
Well, if you'd like to see what we're up to, just simply go to www.electricjukebox.com.
And that sounded very smooth. I like that.
Oh, thank you. It's very well practiced. And you can see what we're up to and Stephen Fry's videos and Robbie Williams, they're all on there. So,
are you on Twitter personally or is it just corporately?
No, just corporately. I'm not an active tweeter right now. But clearly, at some point, I'll have a robot to do that for me.
Fair enough. Well, there's no robot tweeting for me at the moment. For anyone that wants to listen to or read my name tweets, I'm at Paul W.R. Blanchard. You can also go to the Media Focus Twitter account for breaking media news. That's at media_focus_UK, curated expertly by the fair Hannah Thompson. But that's it. Thank you ever so much for listening. My name's Paul Blanchard. The associate producer was Jordan Greenaway. Catch you next time.
A Big Things Media production.
Big Things!